Welcome everybody here today to the board meeting. It's like you've got a good gallery. So if we could, let's get started. Everybody would read through the minutes. Get somebody to look through those minutes. Move forward.
I've already read the minutes before we got here. Did you guys?
Yeah.
Motion to approve them?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Next on the agenda, we basically have, we are going to need to adopt the minutes on the teleconference also. We need to do that separate from the original minutes.
Same motion.
Second.
We have the same motion and second for that. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. We don't have any need for an executive session. License report for July through September. Kathy?
Right. The last meeting that we actually had, I indicated that I would start looking at the licenses that had lapsed and reinstated and send out letters, and I have started that process. I have had some responses on that, but I wanted to let you know that a lot of the Bell agents are actually writing business when their license has lapsed and when they haven't been associated back to the agency. So I would really caution you to go, if you own an agency, to go on our website so that you can put in a person's name and assure yourself that they've got a current license and that they are actually associated to your agency. And even on a monthly, or when their license is up for renewal, if you did that, that would be.
And I believe those licenses expire on their birthday. So.
Huh? Oh, they expire on the birth month every 2 years. And if your license has lapsed or expired and you haven't reinstated it, any bonds that you're writing during that time, not only are you responsible for not being designated to an agency, but the agency is responsible for allowing you to write bond when you're not designated to them. So there are repercussions that can happen and do happen.
Do we have any questions there?
I have a question. Is there any action taken against those parties?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there is. One of the things that we look at is how many bonds were written during that time, the amount, the premiums, and we look and determine what course of action it could be. It could be as little as a private letter of admonition. It could go up to it could be a forfeiture, it could be a surrender in lieu. So
if I understand it correctly, the agent is appointed to an agency.
Yes.
Is writing a bond, but
yes,
not reporting it through the agent. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is an agent, license lapsed. They're assuming their license is still active. They get an email and it says your license is ready to expire. You need to renew your license. If you don't, then it goes down, and so do your appointments go down. Randy Overshoot will be talking a little bit more about that with producer licensing. But when that happens, a lot of agents still continue to write bond when their license is down for the agency. So they get the bond.
The agencies need to be more diligent to be sure that happens.
They can both be fined. The agency.
Are we going to change anything to where the agency is notified also and not just the agent?
Randy will be speaking to that too. The next item up is the audits. I am still in the process of finishing up four different audits that I started. So some of them are a little further along than others, but they will be completed. I have seen some trust violations, so that's another item that, you know, everybody needs to be cognizant of, making sure that the trust money is deposited into a trust account when appropriate, and that it's only released at when it's appropriate to release it.
And when it comes to other business, there's some things I was going to bring out on that.
Okay, that sounds good.
I'll bring that out then.
All right. We need to go over the bail bond monthly reporting information. So basically what's happened is a lot of the I cases that were opened during the 3 months involve judgment forfeitures. Some the courts recalled and some of them were paid off. So that's why you see some of them have a longer days than the 5 days. Some of that is because of weekends. Some of it's also because the courts asked me to wait a few more days on having the judgment of forfeiture paid to them. And in regards to the courts recalling the forfeiture judgments, some of the courts are actually allowing payment plans on the judgment of forfeitures. So that's their control. I just get the paperwork when they determine to send it to the Department of Insurance.
And you may not know this. You have to know if they will allow payment plan on more than one forfeiture. If there's only one forfeiture, they're allowing a payment plan. If there's multiple forfeitures, are they taking that into consideration? Do you know?
I believe it just depends on the individual court. Some of them I'll get the judgment of forfeiture, and they've indicated that they've kept one case on the same agency, but they haven't sent that to me because of the payment plan that's been made. And you see the open enforcement cases, there's one in there. Part of the reason why it's over 300 days is because of the case and the fact that it has to be, there's a probationary period, so we're watching things on that particular case. So if there's a question on that.
There's one on here that says review of financials.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a concern where collateral, I guess a financial situation, or the stability could have changed between the time of licensing and the present?
Those could all be factors. So we have, that's all I have on the reports. Does anybody have any more questions on those?
Yeah. Question, Kathy?
Yes.
Not appointed to an agency, does that just mean they're kind of doing their own single person?
As what we were talking about, it's probably in conjunction with the fact that their license lapsed, so they weren't appointed to the agency, and they wrote a bond at that particular point in time.
So they were kind of doing with the agency, just not formally appointed as such.
Okay. Or the agency license could have lapsed also.
I see.
And Randy can talk more about that.
I was just wondering if we were seeing some individual out there just giving them bonds.
Yeah, just going rogue. What we see is just a lot of inability to remember that they should make sure that their license is up.
And well, procedures. Gotcha. Thanks.
Questions on maybe enforcement issues? Looks like new business. That would be the application to Best Bell Bonds.
Right. At the last telephonic meeting that we had, there were a couple requests that were made of Wendy Madrill, and there were some concerns regarding some judgments, so I'd like to speak to that at this time. The judgments that were mentioned were 0904, 06402, 0904, 03255, and 0880006138. These judgments were done in 2008 and 2009, respectively. In 2010, Wendy Madrill filed a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and the judgments were discharged, meaning that they were released and removed. The court records do not reflect that, but that is what had happened on that. When Wendy Madrill applied in 2011 for a resident limited line license, there was a question on the initial application for a producer to speak to judgments and bankruptcies. Wendy would have had to answer yes if the judgments rendered against her were for money judgments that involved insurance, or if her Chapter 7 bankruptcy involved money she was holding for others in a fiduciary capacity. Because neither situation applied, her answer no was correct. So I hope that answers the question regarding the judgments. Regarding the list that Wendy was requested to provide for the bonds that she had written from 2011 to 2013, in 2011 she wrote a total of 301 bonds. In 2012 she wrote a total of 158. And in 2013, she wrote a total of 103. So when you add all those together, she wrote 562 bonds. So if you take the 2,000 hours and you divide it by 562 total bonds, it equals out to 3.5 hours per bond.
And I believe, I'm speaking for the commissioner, but I believe his bond was 500 bonds, and that probably meet the criteria. Right?
That is what I remember him saying.
Does anybody have any questions on the Best Bell Bonds and the drill application?
Oh, excuse me, there is one more thing that I needed to mention. We were originally requested to find out the formation date for DJ Residential doing business as Best Bell Bonds because it was not on the application. And that date is August 29th, 2011.
Does anybody have any questions on Best Bell Bonds?
Is the residential company still operating a business as residential?
Yes, it is.
Pardon me?
Yes, it is.
And you also have a DBA.
For Best Bail Bonds.
That just procedurally, that just seems odd that you would operate a business under one when you're filing for a fictitious name, say, a fictitious name operation.
Well, it's legally.
Oh, no, I didn't say it wasn't legal.
And the reason we did it was because we could have actually gotten a, whatever it is, a bond based on the real estate that we owned, but DJE Residential is the owner of those real estates. So instead of getting a bond or a bank, you know, and a, you know, a guarantee, whatever the term is, we just decided to just do a DBA.
So my concern is later, legally, you have a right to file an action against someone that you posted a bond for. But if they're sued, if you're suing under the residential company, they won't have any recollection of who that is or knowledge of who that is and may fail to appear.
Oh, we could certainly, you know, I've used a DBA before. I used to own 7 Great Clips hair salons. We were Great Clips 3 because every franchisee had its own different organization, and we were DBA Great Clips. And so basically, your correspondence is usually just DJE Residential, DBA Best Bonds, Best Bail Bonds. So it's great.
Do you have any experience with that?
Well, it is registered. Registered.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Kathy's verified.
Yes.
I mean, we could go
but it's
on
registered with the Department of Commerce.
Yes.
Not just here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We can print out. I could go on a website right
no,
now.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
If someone goes in to check the bail bond name, they're going to show that it's you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. a little bit of an odd DBA from our
existence. Yeah, just go corporations.utah.gov and you can pull it up.
Sure.
Right. And I do have the information regarding that. I presented it in the July meeting.
Well, thank you for looking into those questions, Kevin. So,
question. So, in our teleconference, you were adamantly, when the judgments were brought up, you were adamant that they were not your judgments.
They weren't mine.
And that you knew nothing about.
But I just honestly just barely went through a really vigorous credit check. I was thinking there's no way that I have something that's out there. Because I had just gone through everything. I just bought a new house, so I cleared everything, and they never came up before. So.
Kaiser's okay with the hours?
Yes, in our...
Because I know expressed...
At least my impression or my understanding was if it was over the 500 bonds that she'd written during that time, he felt that that was sufficient. It does, if you do the math, it translates out to 3.5 hours per bond in general.
So I just make a motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimous. Next, we have it.
I've been working on this for very long.
We might need somebody to help Kathy carry that.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
The next new application is one that I am making, so I'm probably going to turn word over to Gordon, our vice chair, and I'll sit down here. Go ahead.
Okay. The application is for Pond Solutions LLC doing business as Extreme Bail Bonds. I do have a copy of the articles or organization of Pond Solutions LLC. It was dated January 3rd, 2002. 2012. The members are J.A. Gustafson, B.A. Jenkins, and M.R. Jenkins. I do have the EIN for Pond Solutions LLC. In regards to the Department of Commerce, the listing for Extreme Bail Bonds doing business of Pond Solutions LLC as of September the 21st, 2012. The Department of Commerce also lists Pond Solutions LLC as of January 3rd, 2012, and showing a DBA for Extreme Bail Bonds. Both the Department of Commerce under both names shows that they're current and active. I have the CPA compilation report for Pond Solutions LLC. It's listing the assets, the liabilities, the members' equity income basis for 2014. Additionally, the CPA who prepared the documents provided a letter dated October the 9th, 2015, stating the net worth of the company is $556,320. Regarding the 2,000 hours for Brad Jenkins, his license number is 109102. He has been licensed with the Department of Insurance since July 15th, 1998. I do have the IRS tax information for the years 2012, 2013, 2014 was not available at that moment. I have a letter from Melody Jenkins, the qualifying active officer with A Sportsman Bail Bond, stating that Brad Jenkins has been in the bail bond business for over 20 years and has met the 2,000 hour requirement. I did also have requests from them a bail bond list providing the bonds written by Brad Jenkins for the last 5 years. And so in 2011, there were a total of 444 bonds written by Brad. 2012 is 414. 2013 is 345. 2014 is 213, and currently with 2015, there's 211 bonds so far. So there's a total of 1,627 bonds written during that time. I also checked Court Exchange, and there are no outstanding judgments. I do have the 2013 tax information for Pond Solutions LLC, and also the 214 tax information for Pond Solutions LLC. I have a copy of the operational account for Extreme Bail Bonds, and they are their operational account with the signature card is at America First Credit Union. Their trust account is also at America First Credit Union for Extreme Bail Bonds. And I do have a copy of the liquid account for Extreme Bail Bonds at America First Credit Union. And the amount currently in there is $100,990. So at this present time, they do meet the requirements to have $300,000 worth of assets, at least $100,000 must be liquid. Brad Jenkins does have the hours, the 2,000 hours, to be the designated representative.
Any questions?
I just have a question. So you already have Sportsman Bail Bond, and is that business, is that, do you have a surety, or that's a collateral?
It's collateral back also.
So you're just opening another one?
Not using the same assets.
Not using the same assets. Okay, I'm just more curious as to why.
Differential marketing.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The roll passes. Turn time back over to Brad. Motion passed.
Why not get it passed? That exchange looked up was nice.
Congratulations, Brad.
You're going to make a joke.
The next, associations and designations. Producer licensing specialist.
Randy's first.
Okay, we don't have Randy on here, but I see him there, so let's let Randy.
Well, Kathy had approached me and mentioned that there are some things that would like somebody from licensing to do. So I decided I would regarding bail bond licensing and renewals, particularly renewals, I suppose. We have a renewal notification that goes out to the email address on file, agencies as well as to individuals whose licenses come up for renewal. They usually go out approximately 75 days, so about 2.5 months prior to the renewal, an email notification should go out. So hopefully people aren't being caught by surprise. As far as individuals, the other thing is they can remember what month they were born. Every 2 years at the end of their birth month is when the license comes up for renewal. And there is a requirement in statute and also in the rule that licensees maintain their email addresses. Have them on file with the insurance department so that we have your correct business email address. So,
may I ask, are most of the companies keeping those current their email addresses?
Yes.
I think that was a problem a couple of years ago.
I sent out some emails and to everybody, and they went out. There was not one that bounced back. So,
and we did have some. Occasionally, there'll be something that bounces back, but we had that same problem with regular snail mail. You know, I mean, you send them out,
yeah,
and returned, and actually, we've had less returns on that emails than we have when we're monitoring it during that year for sure. We there are less returns actually on the emails than there were on the regular mail. So. But again, particularly with individuals who, as Kathy said, were particularly concerned. concerning some individuals whose license might lapse and they didn't renew it on time or well, I didn't know. We do try to notify them as well as make it as a national standard, but you know, try to make it easier to remember by having it on their month of their birth. For agencies, it's every year. For individuals, it's every 2 years. And the agencies is, of course, in July. Of, you know, it's in the summertime of July 15th, sort of. It's done by July 15th, I think, actually, will be August. So a licensee can also look up the time on our agent lookup on our website. insurance.gov, and there's a right there on the front screen, you can look the agent lookup. They can always look up and see their look up their license, and it'll show the it should show you know when it renews and the expiration date. So, question about what year cycle they're in, maybe they didn't have a printout. They can also go to circom.com/UDOT up on the left hand side for. Click on the words of print a license, so anybody can print a copy of their license too, and that would have their expiration date on. So it's readily accessible for somebody to know when their license expires. Plus, we do send out a notification. So if a license does lapse, if somebody doesn't renew it, or if it goes down for any other reason, but it's canceled or revoked or whatever, but anytime a license is becomes inactive, those with the association that that individual has with any agencies and or any appointments with an insurer, but I guess with the bail world, they pretty much work through the agency. So that association, which in the statute is called designation, in the electronic system it says association, but anyway, those are terminated when a license goes down, like it lapses and becomes inactive. So then when a license is, when an individual maybe comes in later and pays the fee and gets that application submitted and reinstates that inactive license, which they can do any time up to 1 year. If it goes beyond a year, you have to apply again as a new license, be fingerprinted and all that. But up to 1 year, they can reinstate their license, and reinstatement fee, it's $50 higher than what their regular renewal fee would be, so it is a higher fee, but they can get that license reinstated, and they're not automatically, those associations and designations are not automatically reinstated. If the license is reinstated, it does stay in the rule 244, section 10, it does say that, a person with a reinstated license must complete any required insurer contracts and appointments or agency designations before the reinstated licensee can resume doing business. And actually, it's the agency, the bail agency, that would go in. You can't push yourself up, they have to pull you up. So an insurer would appoint somebody, an agency would designate or get that designation, that association in the electronic system, get that put in place. And the way they would do that is you can go into CIRCON and click in the upper left section. It says maintain associations. Click on maintain associations and then create an association. So it's just like when you did it at first. You have to go in on it, either a new licensee or somebody whose license became inactive and they're reinstated. So when somebody gets a license that didn't have one or that didn't have it, whether forever or you're getting a new one or if they're just now getting one because they didn't have it for a short period, you do as an agency have to go in and electronically put that association or designation in place in order for that person to be authorized to represent that agency. And there's a $3.25 cost. The state doesn't charge anything, but anytime you put some designation or associations in place, there's a small fee that the lender, CIRCON, charges. Let's see. What else do you want me to sure they renew separately. Sometimes an individual may have more than one license type. Like they might have a limited line license with a bail line of authority. And in most cases, they don't have another license, but in some cases, an individual may also have a full producer license where they may be selling some property casualty insurance, for example, and then also handling some bail business on the side, or doing mainly bail with some PNC business on the side or whatever. So they have two separate licenses. Each of those licenses, they need to go in and renew a separate license. Just like somebody that might have a producer license that sells life and health or PNC, whatever line of authority, they may also have in some cases, a consultant license. Potentially, they could also have an adjuster license. Anytime there's another separate license type, they each have their own. It's a separate license, and it has a separate renewal application and cost. So, anything else?
Yes. Oh.
And also, somebody brought up a question as to whether the agencies are notified if an individual's license goes down. I wish. We have, I don't know why it seems to be so hard for them to get that through, but we have submitted a ticket to CIRCON requesting that become a possibility. There was a time when that does happen now with the insurers. If there's an individual license that goes down, the insurers are notified that appointment then becomes inactive. The agencies, if a individual license goes down, are not currently notified of that lapse and that association is no longer in place. But we do have a request in to get that put in place as well, and that hasn't happened yet. We're waiting on CIRCON to get that fix.
Do you know when that might be?
I don't know. Hopefully soon. Maybe it'll be several months still. It's been quite a while since we requested it, and we reminded them and reminded them, but they're still saying they're trying to work through it. And it's apparently a different fix than it was with the insurer one. I mean, it's some different things they have to go through. We do realize the importance of that and the desire and the agencies to have that in place, and we're trying to get that done, but that's a computer issue and it hasn't yet been worked through.
You're working on it, it's out of your
hands. Yes.
And I just wanted to point out one more thing in conjunction with what Randy said. A lot of times I get anonymous information that somebody's license has gone down, but they've seen them doing business at the jails. So that's just kind of a heads up.
You're being watched.
Yes. Big Brother says in yourselves. So,
Mr. Chairman, I suggest that we put on the agenda for next month an update of this producer licensing issue. And that will help the department to be accountable and to have our service provider be accountable to get this done.
And I'll be sure every month until it's accomplished to inform Kathy, because she works with licensing when they're trying to get some of these licenses issued. I'll let her report it. If there's more than the one issue to come up, I'd be glad to come back over. I'll be sure that.
Let's talk offline because we're in the process of renewing the contract with CIRCON. So
okay. Perfect timing. Were there any other questions for Randy? Kathy, you actually got that.
Yeah. So about 3 or 4 months ago, we implemented a filing access on our website where you can actually access your form filings, your rate filings, your rule filings. And so here are some brief print screens that you want to follow along. Just to see how easy it is to go to our website, and you'll choose the property and casualty, type in your company name if you are collateral backed. If you're surety backed, you're going to type in your insurer's name because they're the ones filing those forms on your behalf.
any filings. I believe our system is for bail bonds 2010 to current. And you can see what is the most recent form filings that your company has filed. I just want to maybe add a reminder that for new companies that do become licensed, that you can't submit your forms until you're active, and once you do, it's 30 days before you can use them.
That's if there's no problems, correct?
That's if there's no problems, yeah.
So if you approve them, can you approve them prior to the 30 days?
So, for example, Extreme was approved hypothetically today. You would essentially submit your filing, and your forms would be effective 30 days from today.
So you have to wait 30 days regardless of how long it takes.
Yeah. And then I make every effort to not wait the full 30 days to review those, because certainly we want you to be able to use those forms at that 30th day. So.
Thank you.
It says on the first page here, the written form filings are now accessible through public records requests?
Yes. So when you click on that link, it then takes you to the next page.
Oh.
And you can click on SERF filing access, and that will take you to our online form rating rule.
So anybody can?
Anything that is not confidential.
And this is for all lines of insurance?
Yes. Well, I can speak for property and casualty, not so much life and health, but any filing that comes through the SERF access, along with home warranties and service contracts and bail bonds that are manually put in there, can be accessed through this site.
Title.
Thank you.
Title as well?
Yes.
So an agent's title? Escrow fees are in there?
The escrow fees are actually, there is a Excel document that they can access to see the spreadsheet of those fees.
So what a title would be in there?
Their forms, their rules, rates that
are... Well, insurers' rates. So we're talking about agencies.
Right. Those are submitted and updated on an Excel spreadsheet under the title section of the website.
But they're still accessible.
They're still accessible and updated every time we get new escrow rates.
Thank you.
Yeah. So really,
questions for Kathy?
Well, I was just going to say, so really, anytime you have a question about a form or you can't remember, you can go to SERF, look it up yourself, and see if you're using the same form or the last form that was filed on your behalf. Sometimes people do update their forms and forget to submit them. So that's a good checkpoint for you.
Question.
Yeah.
If you approve a form, another form approved, is the prior form then obsolete, or is it also in person?
You can access all filings that you've done. So if essentially you filed a form today, and 2 months from now you file a new form because of an address change or name change, what have you, you'll still be able to access the form. Just it will still show the most current filing for you, and that would be the one that we would assume that you're using.
Could be the latest. Is there a way for members of the board who aren't an agency to access these?
Anybody from the public can access this.
Oh.
Yeah. If you just simply go to our website, and I've highlighted on the first page, you'll want to, towards the top, click on the agency company option, and that will take you to the rates and forms.
Oh, okay. I'll ask Brett, is it appropriate in this business section, because I was going through the process of working with my company, and had some interesting issues about trust accounts and things, and what is it doing?
You know, I think it would be fine to discuss it. You wouldn't be able to take any action on it just because it wasn't a case.
It's basically just information. But what I'd like to say is, as I was going through this process, the bank that we normally use, and I use the name U.S. Bank, as I went to open a trust account, they notified me that they would not, company policy, they will not open a trust account for Belmont Company. I said, and some people were nodding their heads, and I said, I know there are people that have trust accounts with you, and they said they will be receiving a letter shortly saying that they're going to need to find a new bank. And as I checked with a few others, that isn't just U.S. bank policy, but it is moving towards, it's moving that direction. And so I'm wondering, just for the department to think about, I'm wondering if we need to change or adopt something in the rule, because basically they were telling me that soon you're not going to have a Belmont Trust account. Nobody's going to have one. They're not going to allow that.
Years ago, Zion sent out for attorney IALTA, small practitioners, because there's hardly any real funds in it. And they just stop. And if there's not a lot of activity and they're not earning money, and you don't have another account to offset their expense, they're just not going to do it.
But we've had all our accounts.
No, I mean, it's a bigger landscape than just all of your accounts.
Exactly.
They look at it nationally.
So anyway, I'm wondering if the department wants to start looking at that or thinking about it, because from their indication and everything I was finding, I was seeing a lot of heads nod. The time is not too far away when you cannot have a Belmont Trust account.
Do you think if you...
Could we have some other designation, I mean a separate account, or because just that word trust, you cannot put trust on.
Did they give you something regarding the policy?
I've asked for that, and I haven't got it back yet, but I check with them every day, and I'm going to continue doing that until I get it.
Do you use fiduciary account or something?
Exactly. Yeah. If we could use any other term than trust, because the time's not too far away when we are not.
But there's got to be a legal designation that they know it's not your money.
Exactly.
You could call it for whatever you want, but they have to distinguish it.
Exactly. That's what I'm asking them.
So didn't we run into that issue with a property and casualty insurer? It was a property and casualty agents were collecting premium, and the rule of the law says it has to be in a trust account, but the banks were calling it something different.
They were calling it a premium account.
A premium account. So I'm sure we can work through this as long as the...
But they were
what we have is a fiduciary account that's not your money. It's being held for the benefit of somebody else.
Called collateral account.
The rule actually says it needs to be called a trust account or words of similar import. So if they want to call it fiduciary account, or
if we can find that similar import, we're okay, because otherwise the time's going to come when people can't find that.
They're not going to say trust.
Trouble, so if we could be proactive and maybe come up with that other term as soon as possible.
Do you remember what we did with this?
I think we allowed them to use premium account.
Premium account is not anybody else's money.
Right.
It's
insured.
It's the insurer's money at that point.
Fiduciary.
But the agent was still holding it for the insurer.
But if the agent holds it for the insurer, the insurer is responsible for the agent. It's the question comes if somebody garnishes that money or drafts out of it. The bank has a heightened responsibility for those funds because they're not your money. Where the insurer and the agent have a special relationship.
Right.
So with fiduciary...
This is going to be... I'm suspecting this is like the first domino. The banks, they're going to charge you for this.
But it started falling. It was tough. It was hard to find.
The Zions? Did you go to Zions?
America First.
America First is where we ended up.
Because Zion's been very, very good.
Credit unions are a lot easier than they are. I think we'll eventually find that the larger banks just don't want to deal with it. And that's where they're at. None of the large banks. And I didn't check Zion's personally, but I can check my wife.
I did check Zion's.
What's that?
And I had a lot of trouble. I was able to get it done, but it's hard.
Yeah. So you enjoy you make some the larger banks, and there are no small banks.
True. Yeah. So I guess it's the credit unions that are left, and even the credit unions said that they would do it, but they have had some rumors and some murmurings. So I'm just saying, if you look at that now, maybe come up with another word when we get those letters.
It's not so much the word, I think, Brad. I think it's more the protection that's in that account, and I don't know what the.
I don't either. I'm just throwing that out because I know somebody's going to be calling Kathy saying, Kathy, it says I have to have a trust account. They will not do it. I've got 30 days and this account's going to be closed. What do I do? And at that point, I think it'd be better to have an
I think the rule gives you an out. You can designate it at something. The risk is that the bank doesn't recognize it.
America First was good.
Right. She said that you can name the account anything you want that you have to name it. They were the only people, Zion, U.S. Bank, they would do any trust account, period, for me. That was like my last issue, even the day before I came here. So yeah, you have to, but America First said that they can designate an account with any kind of name. They can name anything.
And it was our responsibility exactly to handle it however we did would.
The risk is if it's the bank isn't unnoticed that that's trust account or similar designation. And there's any kind of judgment or you've got a garnishment against you or a judgment against you, they can seize that money. And the code says that this money is not to be used to pay the obligations of the agency. And it would be used at that point.
And so I
it's
almost,
a bigger problem.
Exactly, and I'm almost wondering because that is the terminology that America First used. We don't care what you call it. Because how you handle the funds is up to you, which tells me they could probably seize those funds.
Yep. Mine is listed as a trust account, which I'm sure yours is too.
Ours is too.
But there was only certain people in the bank. I had to go to another branch because most of them knew they were like a trust account. What? No, that's a risk.
Exactly. And so it's because on our audits, it didn't matter what account it was as long as it said trust. But what I'm saying is I don't think that America, I'm getting in trouble with this, I don't think America First is going to consider that a trust account if somebody came to lean it.
There was an issue because I think the rule and the code say that it has to be listed as and named as a trust account. And there was one bank, I can't recall, they refused to do it. To call it that.
The U.S.
And then what happened is when there was an audit, it was like this wasn't designated as a trust account. The checks all say trust account. But when they look at the official bank records, it just looks like the next account.
That's exactly where we might be. But the checks say trust.
Our client
says trust account, but I don't think, honestly, I don't think they're going to treat it as a trust account.
No.
So,
but you can't govern the bank.
Exactly, we can't govern the bank. I'm just saying at some point in time, we might just want to look at this because now that you brought that up, that could be a possibility.
Our client had to change banks. I mean, that's how bad it was.
Yeah.
Well, we did, but even America First credit union said there have been rumblings.
Right. Very few trust accounts.
So I'm just saying if that comes down, think about it now.
And more than just the bank, it's
even U.S. Bank and the other banks we said the only trust account they were allowing was an attorney trust account. They did say, Steve.
But I'm guessing if you were a firm, they would take that. You walked in as an individual, or I walked in as an individual, they're going to say.
They did say the only trust account is what they were allowed to designate was an attorney trust account. That was it. I said, are you sure? Because we've got these that show
you're going to get letters. Just don't read your mail.
Because that's going to affect not only insurance, but I would imagine construction. There's a lot of places that have to have trust accounts.
Or often referred to as escrow accounts.
Yeah, anything that's, I mean, could we just call it escrow?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up. I don't have an answer for you today, but what I will do today is I'll contact the my counterpart, the Financial Institutions Division, and then we'll probably have some interaction as we move closer to the legislative session with the lobbyists for the Bankers Association, Howard Headley, and get that on his radar. And at least make people aware of it.
And that's all I was trying to do here, is make you aware
of it. And then, Kathy, if you hear this happening, I'd like to know.
Okay.
We'll see what options we might have.
Any other thoughts there? Or?
I'm just wondering if you might inquire the NAIC. We can't be the only state that's had people have the problem.
Yeah,
we
could do that.
I have a question basically for you, Brad. I've received calls from, I was counted up as I came in this morning, probably 7 to 8 bail bond companies that are kind of feeling like they're being left in the dark with the changes to the code that's coming out of the Department of Insurance. They ask me questions and I don't have an answer. And I'm kind of like, well, to be honest with you, I kind of feel like that I'm left in the dark too.
Yeah, I was going to mention that in our other business and talk to about where we are on that and what the board wants to do. Thank you.
Okay, should we go to old business? Update on the bail bond board opening.
The commissioner has received applications. I've given him some information. He's still in the process of making a determination. So that's where we are at this present time.
Do you have any idea how long it might be before one is designated?
I think it'll be fairly shortly, and I'm highly confident that it'll be before our next scheduled meeting.
Who's up?
Craig.
Craig got his plaque and he's gone.
Oh.
And Boogie.
I was reappointed.
Other business. Open the January 14th, 2015 minutes to make a change and have the minutes approved.
We'd like to make a motion to open the minutes so that we can make a change regarding the information on Darren Brady's Chapter 11 personal bankruptcy.
Somebody needs to make that motion.
I motion.
Do you have a sex? All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries.
The minutes should reflect that Darren Brady filed a personal Chapter 11 bankruptcy in January.
And how did it?
As opposed to what?
As opposed to, it stated that it was Rebel Bail Bonds filing a Chapter 11.
Over the hours and how we accumulate those and how we track those. I really think we need to look at that and find a better way of tracking or doing that because, I mean, it put her and her ability to bond off for a very long time and it just doesn't seem like we're very, it's not fair. Kanye.
So structure the qualifications.
Structure the qualifications, come, you know, the idea of having a bond list and being able to go to that list to say, hey, this is how many bonds, this is how many hours it might take to get those 2,000 hours. I just think it's kind of it's all over the place. And I don't think relying on a former boss who may be a competitor is very fair.
Or an ex-spouse.
Or an ex-spouse.
So the other part is, can you equate the number of bonds to hours? We won't have that information, but you guys will.
Right.
Is that a fair situation? So if somebody is scraping or it's a bad year and they only issued 75 bonds, but they worked all year, that wouldn't be equitable.
Probably not, because that is the work is on the bond.
It's hustling
on the bond. You're not working.
Right.
So,
pardon me?
If you're not working on a bond, you're really not working.
But if you're out soliciting business, you're trying to get business.
That would be more in marketing, and it wouldn't give you any experience, which is a
$2,000 bond,
which is what we are looking for.
So what if you're working a large bond for a month, Brad? I don't think that's a fair assessment.
Well, I agree, and we're going to have something in the middle, and that's for the department to answer, but... We all work on large bonds, but...
Well, but and that's an extreme situation, but what I'm saying is that under that circumstance, if you have an agency that only wrote 75 bonds and that person's applying, I think there's other factors that play into what's done on a day-to-day workday for a bondsman other than just taking calls that they are working bonds. That's why.
I would consider what three of us are doing right here is... bond work.
Exactly. Or you go into the bank and finding out that the banks may not allow us to have trust accounts, or the phones at the jail are down, or there's 100 different things that can go in and you're not working on a bond that can be considered hours.
May I ask a question of Wayne Carlos?
Yes.
My memory serves that your association chose that 2,000 number.
Yes, we did.
So it didn't come from the department. I just want to clarify that.
But I was just going to say it is a department that determines what is acceptable to meet that 2,000-hour requirement. So maybe that is something that maybe the association and the department can get to and help clarify.
Yeah, we're committed to finding a more objective standard. One of the problems we run into with bail in particular is unlike somebody that goes to get a PNC license to do personal auto or commercial auto, we have required training that they have to do and tests they have to pass. And we did have that in the bail industry. We did have that under Utah law for a couple of years, but the industry is small enough that we didn't have any providers of continuing education that could make it commercially viable. So that's kind of the, you know, we want people that are experienced, but we're not doing training and training requirements like we do in other areas in the insurance department. So,
hey, Brad, I know in California,
yeah,
there's a lot of service providers online now. I mean, the whole industry's changed. So from that point, you may be able to find somebody for licensing or annually or every 2 years for renewal that will offer that service online now, and that may fill the need, so to speak, and at least help to make sure any license changes or DOI changes in the regs are covered there. It may be a kind of a dual, as opposed to it doesn't need to be in a retail setting now.
I think it's kind of a dual-pronged approach. Part of what we're trying to get people to do is understand the bonding industry as a whole, and then you're trying to get them to understand Utah's rules and regulations in the bonding industry.
Exactly.
So California,
yeah, that may be crazy. So let's do what California.
No, I didn't say that's what let's do what California is doing. I said that's what they are doing. And what I'm getting at is that may be a viable option for some to find somebody to do it now, because you don't have all that incurred cost necessarily of the upkeep and making sure you have so many students for a class.
So I will take this on, and to maybe not do an exhaustive study, but an informal look at what other states, you know, in the West are doing. Oklahoma, I usually like to look at, New Mexico, Nevada.
I mean, look what you need to do to go to get a notary. They provide you the information, you study it, you take a test online, you get a notary.
And they try to trick
you. Oh my gosh, yes. But, but I mean, it just seems like we have this a great curriculum right in front of us and the rules and all those things. Why not utilize what's already prepared and then as it changes, make those adopted uses as well? I mean, that seems a little more fair than relying on the education former employee to give you hours.
Yeah, I agree with both of your comments, because there are no licenses that somebody comes in and just affirms that they've been doing this. So this is the only one that I'm aware of. There's a test. So the association should be able to come up with a test.
I think that's something we could work at as an association, because that's the other thing is you can have about 2,000 hours maybe doing something really wrong.
Well, the other part is
exactly. I created my
Right. You know, we hear repeatedly about record keeping, you know, not being the best it could be. So if, to prevent an occurrence where somebody's relying on somebody else, somebody new comes in, takes a test, they can have that license, but if nobody's going to hire them, they're going to need that experience, almost like a tutorship.
I'll take that on, Wayne and I can. Wayne?
I think it's important that the industry itself designs this, because it's not just code and rule, but procedural and market areas is all different. 23 different jails, they all handle things a little bit differently. Hundreds of courts, different processes there. And only we will know what those are, and that's the information that people really should have. So.
You've got to have a mechanism in there to add for updates.
Exactly.
This is all assuming that the bail industry survived the 2016 session.
Is that the legislation? That's what the department's on.
No, I'm talking about the department legislation.
Oh,
there is a statute in the 31A-23A-108, which talks about examination requirements. It's kind of a national standard. It follows the Producer Licensing Model Act, number 5. And it says the commissioner may require an applicant for a particular license type under 23106 to pass a line of authority exam as a requirement for a license, except that an examination may not be required for an applicant for a license under 23106-2C, which is a limited line license. So any line of authority under a limited line license you can't have under the statute and under the Model Act an examination requirement in order to get that license.
Is bail a limited line?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Yes. So what we probably need to do is maybe go this way.
Well, it gets more complicated. So other limited lines are like rental car insurance and storage unit insurance, stuff that,
travel
insurance. The commissioner may require. So
does it say
may?
Yeah, it may require an exam,
except for.
So that's a model law that we have uniformity issues with, that we're always kind of staking off the federal government, saying we're doing this. We're not doing it 56 different ways. So it's something we'll have to. It sounds like it's certainly valid for us to do some work on it. And I'm committed to coming back with some information. Have some options next time. I'd like to work with the association if the association will have any items.
The wording may would not make it.
But in the
we don't have to administer an exam, but we may.
So
as long as it's not a limited line. Then we may not.
Could we, if we just took out limited line on there,
no, because a limited line is still short.
That
and
all
these
other
shots.
It's a model statute.
Sort of thing.
We'll let you guys
retire. Oh, they have.
Well,
there was a license for
resources
somewhere.
In theory.
In the crowd.
But what is an exam, anyways, right? It's all semantics. Okay, Brett, there was something you wanted to bring up.
Yeah, so the insurance department, along with the association and members of the bail bond board, for about 3 years have been going through and working on revising the bail bond chapter, as well as a couple of chapters, and Stephen can probably be more familiar with this, is it Title 21? That has to do with the default judgments and trying to improve it. So Senator Hillier committed to having Bill file under his name to take what we've been working on collectively, which should be no surprise to the association and those that are working on it, to put those into a law, or to put those into a bill and make those changes. I submitted that information 6 or 8 weeks ago, and I haven't heard anything from the drafting attorney. I do have a 2 o'clock meeting with a different drafting attorney, and I'll follow up with her on that. In the meantime, what I submitted is no secret. Y'all should have copies
of
it.
Well, we do, but we've just heard rumoring, and I don't know where the rumoring comes from, but we just heard that when I was there, Wayne was there, Brad was there, you were there, that's been changed. What we discussed has been changed, and things taken out or added, and I'm saying I have no idea. I haven't heard a thing. Is that not true?
No, nothing has changed. I want to say the last draft we worked on was like October of last year, or maybe it was before that. I didn't make any changes to that. It was the same copy that we worked on, and I just forwarded that along with a couple of changes in 22, which we had discussed for 20. Title 21 that I worked on more recently. I have no problem, as soon as we're done with this meeting, forwarding to the association, to anybody that wants a copy of what I sent over, the draft. What the drafting attorney does with it, and you know how they change it. They sometimes change terms of art that we want changed. You know, we need to say premium, not the fee, or so. We'll work through those issues, but we have the department's not done anything.
So the department's bill is going to be added to Hillier's version?
No.
No, this will be its own bail bill.
Good, okay.
I also suspect that the work that the Utah Supreme Court's Committee on Pretrial Release Programs will also be running the bill, and that report, they're going to discuss kind of the final outline of that report at a meeting tomorrow, and then they'll be submitting it to the Supreme Court for consideration in the Supreme Court's November meeting. And I don't know when that November meeting is. I'm involved in another issue trying to change the rule of evidence, and there doesn't feel like they really want anyone but those people on the committee at those meetings. Wayne and I presented 2 months ago, and I'd be happy to provide the presentation I made at the pretrial release program. Gary, not Wayne. Gary's was definitely the most interesting and had the most pop. Kathy was at the meeting. Gary had the soundtrack, Rocky soundtrack, his PowerPoint, and it was really an effective spokesman for the industry. So if anyone's interested, I'll forward you my presentation too.
Can I get one other comment? Wayne and I and Gary met with some people in the industry, and Senator Hillier, that's running these bills for pretrial, came out and said, we are bloodsuckers on the system, and he wants us gone. So that's what we're facing coming up in this legislative session. He said that he may meet with us, but he's already got his mind made up, and he's going to do what he can to do away with the industry.
That's why I was concerned.
So if he has his choice, we're all done come May of 2016. He has his way.
So what's the alternative?
Pretrial. Everybody goes pretrial. They don't care. This is basically what he said. And Wayne, correct me if I'm wrong, because you were there. This is basically what was said. that he had a friend that had a son arrested in Logan on a Friday for a $10,000 bond. The friend calls Hilliard and says, my son's in on this $10,000 bond, and he says to his friend, don't do anything, I'll get him out come Monday. Well, mom and dad didn't want to leave him in jail, so a bond company, which we would all do, posted the bond, and Hilliard was furious that we, whoever it was, we don't even know who it was, had a, quote, $1,000 windfall on somebody that would have gone to court. So what he says he wants to do is make everybody stay to see the judge and then be released. Everything would be pretrial. He doesn't want bonds.
I don't
so
think
that
that's
what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see it going.
Have a choice of waiting till Monday. It's, no, you're going
to
wait.
He had the parents made the choice to use a bond, which he wants to take that choice away. And I'm not. Wait, am I not saying that correctly?
No, absolutely correct.
Everybody in the industry, this is what we are facing in 2016. Go ahead.
Well. You know, obviously I work on this side of the house, and what I've seen, because we're also in looking at the pretrial release, not getting rid of bonds totally, but making them see the judge first and letting the judge post the bond.
Relegating no bonds.
Yes. So instead of attaching the fine with the charge, it would be look at the total circumstance and see.
Correct. That's exactly what you're saying. The uniform bail schedule is out
right.
the window.
Uniform bail will be gone. The judge will make that call.
So is it going to be a 24-hour judge?
Exactly. I mean, it may or may not, because there are some folks that can't afford bail regardless.
But it's still awesome.
It doesn't change for them.
And they sit for 14 days in jail. So that's just what they're looking at, but I don't know that it's going to go completely the way I see it leaning towards the judge making.
See, the person that can't afford bail can wait, and the judge can do it anyway.
Exactly.
So all you're doing is taking away one option.
And just so you guys
somebody
know,
sit in that you're going to lose your job because we can't get you out of
it. Right.
So
right.
you're
oh,
doing
yes.
far more there's, damage to all you
in 2014, there was 109,000 active warrants on the statewide system. Since they went to this cash bail, and I got this information from BCI, and I have it. Since they went to the cash bail system in Utah County, and all this thing about they don't care if the defendant appears, there's over, as of July, there's over 212,000 warrants on the failure to appear system. So the state thinks, and they do this system, you're going to take 212,000 warrants, you're going to go to 500,000 warrants in a year. It was over 100,000 warrants in 1 year. And all they did was tweak it just a little bit. So,
from what I've seen, they're specifically not addressing cash bail with this, just because that's a whole different
thing. Right, they're not.
Right.
You're right.
And
but they want to do away with bail. If you're
well,
looking at
I,
crime
my
class.
Sense is similar to Lieutenant Boots,
yeah.
that bail.
It's not. I don't think
that. So I guess kind of the basis is if you're innocent, you shouldn't spend a day in jail.
Right.
But. They have to do some sort of an analysis to see if you have a risk of recidivating, a risk to the community, and a risk not to show up for a hearing.
Right.
So if they can somehow manage those risks, I still think bail will be a part of the system, but based on what I have seen, I don't think it will be as big of a part of the system. And I think the judges really want to get away from just adding zeros to the end of a bail amount and instead saying, this person should not be bailed out.
Right.
Here's the reason why. Instead
looking
of
at crime
bail
class.
In 5 million.
You know, where are they in the community? Are those three things? There's so many different
what
things.
What percentage
of incarcerated person fits in that category where a judge feels like he has to add a bunch of zeros to keep him in jail? That's such a small percentage.
Yeah, yeah, like 1/1,000 or less.
Or less.
That should hardly be a consideration.
The acid test is who appears in court.
Yep,
that's it.
And that's what we're tracking. We track everybody that comes in, and if they show up to their first court appearance.
0.0038% of bondsmen don't appear, bonded people don't appear.
Mm-hmm.
And the best pretrial records out there, maybe 49% appear.
And another thing
I see just the opposite. So,
yeah. Who's
presenting at what situation?
So, how are you tracking that? Because that's what's important. Because you can create any test group to come up with the numbers you want by eliminating certain things.
We are tracking every, just for our county, I'm tracking every individual who comes through the door.
How can somebody?
We don't. Yeah.
How can it be more effective for somebody to promise they're going to show up
versus,
to the court versus somebody that has their mom behind them? It's impossible to say, "Well, I promised the judge that it's not as it's that's more important than promising my mom who put up her house,
right,
who can find me if I need to." It's those are so skewed.
Fine.
That I can't even begin to believe that's the case.
Over 200 years of history of a Belmont process, if a promise worked, that's how we would do it. It doesn't work. We already know that. Our enforceable contract is why those people appear.
See, Utah County does it by saying their stats say how many warrants have been put out. 9 out of 10 of them didn't show up, they just didn't put out warrants, so they said,
right,
you didn't have to show any warrants. So that's how they come up with that.
Yeah, we're tracking every detail of each person for a year before we do anything. There's a lot of data that needs to be collected.
Have you guys looked at Colorado where they did a major pretrial overhaul and now they're
Mesa?
Looking at bringing bail back?
We're looking at all of those. You guys weren't here for ECR.
Yeah.
But ECR, they basically did the same thing and dropped ECR because it didn't work. The other thing that needs to be pointed out is Utah's had pretrial in Salt Lake for, 30-plus years, 40 years maybe? Nobody, and you can confirm this or deny it, I don't know, but I've been told from somebody that was at the meeting, nobody's brought up any of the Utah pretrial stats. None of them. None of them have been presented saying, this is such a good program, we need to do this in the
whole
thing.
Gathering that data.
And the judges aren't using what they're gathering.
So that's where we came in. We're like, wait, we want to see exactly what's going on in our county. And so we decided to take a year off just to kind of go back as long as the legislature wants to make us do anything.
They did track Salt Lake County.
They won't release
it. But they won't
release
it because people work in jail.
And so we're making an issue of that, too. But anyway, everybody needs to just realize, you know, we're in hot water. And they did this to the federal system where they said, well, we'll bring bail in, you know, it'll be like as a last resort. And I don't think a bond company's written a federal bond in 15, 20 years. And that's in Utah. They write them in other states.
If there's no other questions, motion. We're going to be in motion. We are adjourned. Let's go.
You know, they have some from the pretrial program there, but I don't remember finding a lot of it. It was more anecdotal.
No, that was he's actually from California.
Is Todd the guy in the white shirt? No jacket.
Yeah, that's Todd.